in the mirror and tried to understand what she had seen. Had Kraft blushed? And if so, what did that mean? Maybe nothing, she decided. Absolutely nothing. And even if it really was shame or guilt that Grana had read in her face, it could have been about almost anything. It occurred to her that she did not know her boss all that well, but she knew enough to realize that Kraft would not send a child to his death for financial or any other gain. No, that was out of the question. Grana had simply become paranoid, a typically suspicious spy who saw moles everywhere, even in her own reflection. Idiot, she muttered, and smiled at herself despondently, as if to dismiss the idea and come back down to earth. But that didn't solve anything. In that instant, she thought she saw a new kind of truth in her own eyes. She suspected that she was quite like Helena Kraft, in that she was capable and ambitious and wanted to get a pat on the back from her superiors. That was not necessarily always a good thing. With that tendency, if you operate in an unhealthy culture, you risk becoming just as unhealthy yourself. Who knows? Perhaps the will to please leads people to crime as often as evil or greed does. People want to fit in and do well, and they do indescribably stupid things because of it. Is that what happened here? Hans Faster, because surely he was their source in Bublansky's group, had been leaking to them because that was what he was expected to do and because he wanted to score points with Seppo. Olofsson had seen to it that Kraft was kept informed of every little detail. She was his boss, and he wanted to be in her good books. And then, well, maybe Kraft in turn had passed on some information, because she wanted to be seen as doing a good job. But, if so, by whom? The head of the National Police? The government? Foreign intelligence, in that case most likely American or English, who perhaps then... Grana did not take this thought any further. She asked herself again if she was letting her imagination run away with her. Even if she was, she still could not trust her team. She wanted to be good at her job, but not necessarily by doing her duty to Seppo. She just wanted the Balder boy to be all right. Instead of Kraft's face, she now saw Beria's. So she went to her office and got out her black phone, the same one she had been using to call Franz Balder. Beria had left the office to have an undisturbed conversation and was now standing in front of Söderbokhandel, the bookstore on Jutgatan, wondering if she had done something stupid. Grana had argued her case in such a way that Beria could not defend herself. That is no doubt the disadvantage of having intelligent friends. They see straight through you. Not only had Grana worked out what Beria wanted to talk to her about, she had also persuaded her that she felt a moral responsibility and would never reveal the hiding place, however much that might appear to conflict with her professional ethics. She said she had a debt to repay and insisted on helping. She was going to courier over the keys to her summer house on Ingeru and arrange for directions to be sent via the encrypted link which André Zander had set up. Further up Jutgarten, a beggar collapsed, scattering two carrier bags full of plastic bottles across the sidewalk. Beria hurried over, but the man, who was soon on his feet again, declined her help, so she gave him a sad smile and went back up to the Millennium offices. Blomqvist was looking upset and exhausted. His hair stood on end and his shirt hung outside his trousers. She had not seen him looking so worn out in a long time. Yet when his eyes shone like that, there was no stopping him. It meant he had entered into that absolute concentration from which he would not emerge until he had gotten to the heart of the story.
"Have you found a hiding place?" he said.
She nodded.
"It might be best if you say nothing more. We have to keep this to as small a circle of people as possible."
"That sounds sensible. But let's hope it's a short-term solution. I don't like the idea of Lisbeth Salander being responsible for the boy."
"Who knows? Maybe they're good for each other."
"What did you tell the police?"
"Almost nothing."
"Not a good time to be keeping things under wraps."
"Not really, no."
"Maybe Salander is prepared to make a statement, so you can get some peace and quiet."
"I don't want to put any pressure on her. She's in bad shape. Can you get Zander to ask her if we can send a doctor out there?"
"I will. But you know..."
"What?"
"I'm actually coming round to the idea that she's doing the right thing," Beria said.
"Why do you say that, all of a sudden?"
"Because I, too, have my sources. Police headquarters isn't a secure place right now," she said. and walked over to Andrezander with a determined stride. Chapter 19. November 22nd. Evening. Boblensky was standing alone in his office. In the end, Hans Faster had admitted to keeping Seppo informed, and without even listening to his justification, Boblensky removed him from the investigation. But even if that had provided further evidence that Faster was an unscrupulous opportunist, he could not bring himself to believe that the man had also been leaking to criminals. Inevitably, there were corrupt and depraved people in the force, but to deliver a small, mentally disabled boy into the hands of a cold-blooded murderer was beyond the pale, and he refused to believe that any policeman would be capable of that. Perhaps the information had seeped out by some other route. Their phones might be tapped, or they could have been hacked, though he could not remember notes about August's abilities being entered in any police computer. He had been trying to reach the Seppo head, Helena Kraft, to discuss the matter. He had stressed that it was important, but she had not returned his call. The Swedish Trade Council and the Ministry of Enterprise had called him, which was worrisome. Even if it was not said in so many words, their main concern was not for the boy, or the shooting on Sveavägen, but rather for the research program which Franz Baldo had been working on, which appeared to have been stolen on the night of his murder. Several of the most skilled computer technicians in the force, and three IT experts from Linköping University and the Royal Institute of Technology, had been to the house in Saltsjöbaden, but they had found no trace of this research, either on his computers or among the papers which he had left behind. "So now, on top of everything else, we have an artificial intelligence on the loose," Boblensky muttered to himself. He was reminded of an old riddle his mischievous cousin Samuel liked to put to his friends in synagogue. It was a paradox. If God is indeed omnipotent, is he then capable of creating something more intelligent than himself? The riddle was considered disrespectful, he recalled, even blasphemous. It had that evasive quality which meant that, however you answered, you were wrong. There was a knock at the door, and Boblensky was brought back to the questions at hand. It was Modig, ceremoniously handing over another piece of Swiss orange chocolate. "Thank you," he said. "Have you got anything new?"
"We think we know how the killers got Linden and the boy out of the building. They sent fake emails from our and Professor Edelman's addresses and arranged a pick-up on the street."
"Is that possible?"
"Sure, it's not even very difficult."
"Terrifying."
"True, but that still doesn't explain how they knew to access the Odense Medical Center computer, or how they found out that Edelman was involved."
"Well, I suppose we'd better have our own computers checked out," Boblensky said gloomily.
"Already in hand."
"Is this how it was meant to be? That we won't dare to write or say anything for fear of being overheard?"
"I don't know. I hope not. Meanwhile, we have a Jakub Charo out there waiting to be interviewed."
"Who's he?"
"A footballer. Plays for Syrian FC. He's the one who drove the woman and August Balder away from Sveavägen."
A muscular young man with short dark hair and high cheekbones was sitting in the interview room. He was wearing a mustard-coloured V-neck pullover without a shirt, and seemed at once agitated and a little proud. Modig opened with, 6:35 p.m. on November 22nd. Interview with witness, Jakob Charo, 22 years old, resident in Norbury. Tell us what happened this morning."
"Well," Charo said, "I was driving along Sveavägen and noticed some commotion in the street ahead of me. I thought there'd been an accident, so I slowed down. But then I saw a man come from the left and run across the road. He ran out without even looking at the traffic, and I remember thinking he must be a terrorist."
"Why is that?"
"He seemed to be bursting with this sacred fury."
"Were you able to see what he looked like?"
"Not really, but since then it struck me that there was something unnatural about his face."
"What do you mean?"
"Like it wasn't his real face. He was wearing sunglasses, which must have been secured around his ears, but his cheeks, it looked as if he had something in his mouth, I don't know. Then there was his moustache and eyebrows and the colour of his skin."
"Do you think he was wearing a mask?"
"Something like that. But I didn't have time to think too much about it. Before I knew it, the rear door of the car was yanked open, and then, what can I say? It was one of those moments when everything happens all at once. The whole world comes down on your head. Suddenly, there were strangers in my car, and the rear windscreen shattered.
I was in shock."
"What did you do?"
"I accelerated like crazy. The girl who jumped in was shouting at me to drive, and I was so scared I hardly knew what I was doing. I just followed orders."
"Orders?"
"That's how it seemed.
I reckoned we were being chased, and I didn't see any other way out. I kept swerving, just like the girl told me to. And besides...
Go on.
There was something about her voice. It was so cold and intense. I found myself hanging on to it, as if it were the only thing that was under control in the mayhem.
You said you thought you recognized the woman.
Yes, but not at the time. Definitely not. I was scared to death and was busy concentrating on all the weird things that were happening. There was blood all over the place.
Coming from the boy or the woman?
I wasn't sure at first, and neither of them seemed to know. But then I heard her say, yes, like something good had happened.
What was that about?
The girl realized she was the one bleeding and not the boy. And that really struck me. It was like, hooray, I've been shot. And I tell you, it wasn't some little graze. However, she tried to bandage it. She couldn't staunch the blood. It just kept oozing out, and the girl kept getting paler and paler. She must have felt like shit.
And still she was happy that it wasn't the boy who'd been hit.
Exactly. Like a mother. But she wasn't the child's mother. No, they didn't even know each other, she said, and that became more and more obvious. She didn't have a clue about children.
On the whole, Modig said, how did you think she treated the boy?
Not sure how to answer that, to be honest. I wouldn't say she had the world's best social skills. She treated me like a damn servant.
But even so...
Yes? I reckon she was a good person. I wouldn't have liked her to babysit, if you see what I mean, but she was okay.
So you think the child is safe with her?
She's obviously fucking crazy, but the little boy...
He's called August, right?
That's right. She'll guard August with her life if it came to it. That was my impression.
How did you part company?
She asked me to drive them to Mosabaka Torg.
Is that where she lives, on the square?
I have no idea. She gave me no explanation whatsoever. I got the feeling she had some other kind of transport from there, but she didn't say more than was necessary. She just asked me to write down my details. She was going to pay for the damage to the car, she said, plus a little extra.
Did she look as though she had money?
Going by her appearance alone, I'd say she lived in a dump, but the way she behaved... I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me if she was loaded. You could tell she was used to getting her own way.
What happened then?
She told the boy to get out of the car.
And did he?
He just rocked backwards and forwards and didn't move. But then her tone hardened. She said it was a matter of life and death or something like that, and he tottered out of the car with his arms stiff, as if he was sleepwalking.
Did you see where they went?
Only that it was to the left, towards Slusen. But the girl...
Yes?
Well, she was obviously still feeling like shit. She was weaving about and seemed on the point of collapse.
Doesn't sound good.
And the boy? Probably wasn't in great shape either. He was looking really odd. The whole time in the car, I worried he was going to have some sort of fit. But when he got out, he seemed to have come to terms with the situation. In any case, he kept asking, where? Over and over. Where?
Modig and Bublansky looked at each other.
Are you sure about that? Modig said. Why shouldn't I be?
Well, you might have thought you heard him saying that, because he had a questioning look on his face.
Why would I have thought that?
Because the boy's mother says he doesn't speak at all. Never has, Modig continued.
Are you joking?
No, and it would be odd for him to suddenly start speaking under these very circumstances.
I heard what I heard.
Okay. And what did the woman answer?
Away, I think. Away from here. Something like that. Then she almost collapsed, like I said, and she told me to drive off.
And you did?
Like a bat out of hell.
And then you realized who you'd had in your car.
I'd already worked out that the boy was the son of that genius who'd been murdered, but the girl... She vaguely reminded me of someone. I was shaking like a leaf, and in the end, I couldn't drive any more. I stopped on Ringweg and by Skarnstuhl, got myself a beer at the Clarion Hotel, and tried to calm down. And that's when it hit me. It was the girl who was wanted for murder a few years ago, but then the charges were dropped, and it came out that she'd been through some terrible things in a mental hospital when she was a child. I remember it well. The father of a friend of mine had been tortured in Syria, and he was having more or less the same stuff done to him at the time, electroshock therapy and that sort of shit, because he couldn't deal with his memories. It was like he was being tortured all over again.
Are you sure about that?
That he was tortured?
No. That it was her, Lisbeth Salander.
I looked at all the pictures online, and there's no doubt about it. There were other things that fit too, you know.
Charo hesitated, as if embarrassed.
She took off her T-shirt because she needed to use it as a bandage, and when she turned to wrap it around her shoulder, I saw that she had a large tattoo of a dragon all the way up her back. That same tattoo was mentioned in one of the old newspaper articles.
Beria arrived at Grana's summer house with several shopping bags filled with food, crayons and paper, a couple of difficult puzzles, and a few other things. But there was no sign of August or Salander. Salander had not responded either on her red phone app or on the encrypted link. Beria was sick with anxiety. Whichever way she looked at it, this did not bode well. Admittedly, Salander was not known for unnecessary communication or reassurance, but it was she who had asked for a safe house. Also, she had responsibility for a child, and if she was not answering their calls under those circumstances, she must be in a bad way. Beria swore and walked out onto the terrace to where she and Grana had been sitting and talking about escaping from the world. That was only a few months ago, but it felt like an age. There was no table now, no chairs, no bottles, no hubbub behind them, only snow, branches and debris flung there by the storm. It was as if life itself had abandoned the place. Somehow the memory of that crayfish party increased the sense of desolation, as if the festivities were draped like a ghost over its walls. Mary went back into the kitchen and put some microwavable food into the refrigerator. Meatballs, packets of spaghetti with meat sauce, sausage stroganoff, fish pie, potato cakes, and a whole lot of even worse junk food Blomqvist had advised her to buy. Billy's pan pizza, piroshki, chips, Coca-Cola, a bottle of Tullamore Dew, a carton of cigarettes, 3 bags of crisps, 3 bars of chocolate, and some sticks of fresh licorice. She set out drawing paper, crayons, pencils, an eraser, and a ruler and compass on the large round table. On the top sheet of paper she drew a sun and a flower, and wrote the word Welcome in 4 warm colours. The house was near Ingaru Beach, but you could not see it from there. It lay high up on the rock promontory, concealed behind pine trees, and consisted of 4 rooms. The kitchen, with glass doors onto the terrace, was the largest, and also the heart of the house. In addition to the round table, there was an old rocking chair and 2 worn, sagging sofas, which nonetheless managed to look inviting thanks to a pair of red tartan rugs. It was a cozy home. It was also a good safe house. Beria left the door open, put the keys in the top drawer of the hall closet, as agreed, and wandered down the long flight of wooden stairs flanking the steep, smooth rock slope, the only way to the house for anyone arriving by car. The sky was dark and turbulent, the wind blowing hard again. Her spirits were low and did not improve during the drive home. Her thoughts turned to Hannah Balder. Beria had not exactly been a member of the fan club. Hannah often played the parts of women who were both sexy and dim-witted, whom all men thought they could seduce, and Beria was disgusted by the film industry's devotion to that type of character. But none of that was true any longer, and Beria regretted that she had been so ungracious at the time. She had been too hard on the woman. It was only too easy to criticize a pretty girl who gets a big break early in her career. Nowadays, on the rare occasions Hannah Balder appeared in a major production, her eyes tended to reflect a restrained sorrow, which gave depth to the parts she played, and what did Beria know? That may have been genuine. She had been through some difficult times, not least the past 24 hours. Since morning, Beria had been insisting that Hannah be taken to August. This was surely a situation in which a child needed his mother more than ever. But Salander, who was still communicating with them at the time, had been against the idea. No one yet knew where the leak had come from, she had written, and they could not rule out the mother's immediate circle. Lasse Westman, for one, whom nobody trusted, seemed to be staying in the house all day to avoid the journalists camped outside. They were in a bind, and Beria did not like it. She hoped Millennium would still be able to tell the story with dignity and depth, without the magazine or anyone else coming to harm. She had no doubt that Blomqvist would be up to it, given the way he looked right now. Besides, he had Xander to help him. Beria had a soft spot for Xander. Not long ago, over dinner at her and Gregor's house in Saltsjöbaden, he had told them his life story, which had only increased her sympathy. When Xander was 11, he lost both his parents in a bomb blast in Sarajevo. After that he came to live in Tensta, outside Stockholm, with an aunt who altogether failed to notice either his intellectual disposition or the psychological wounds he bore. He had not been there when his parents were killed, but his body reacted as if he were suffering from post-traumatic stress.
To this day he detested loud noises and sudden movements. He hated seeing unattended bags in public places, and loathed violence with a passion Berrier had never encountered before. As a child he sought refuge in his own worlds. He immersed himself in fantasy literature, read poetry and biographies, adored Sylvia Plath, Borges, and Tolkien, and learned everything there was to know about computers. He dreamed of writing heart-rending novels about love and human tragedy, and was an incurable romantic who hoped that great passion would heal his wounds. He was not in the least bit interested in the outside world. One evening in his late teens, however, he attended a public lecture given by Mikael Blomkvist at the Institute for Media Studies at Stockholm University, and it changed his life. Blomkvist's fervour inspired him to bear witness to a world which was bleeding with injustice and intolerance and petty corruption. He started to imagine himself writing articles critical of society instead of tear-jerking romances. Not long after that he knocked on Millennium's door and asked if there was anything they would let him do, make coffee, proofread, run errands. Berrier, who had seen the fire in his eyes right from the start, assigned him some minor editorial tasks, public notices, research, and brief portraits. But most of all she told him to study. And he did so with the same energy he put into everything else. He read political science, mass media communications, finance, and international conflict resolution. And at the same time he helped out on temporary assignments at Millennium. He wanted to become a heavyweight investigative journalist, like Blomkvist. But unlike so many other investigative journalists, he was no tough guy. He remained a romantic. Blomkvist and Berrier had both spent time trying to sort out his relationship problems. He was too open and transparent, too good, as Blomkvist would say. But Berrier believed that Xander was in the process of shedding that youthful vulnerability. She had been seeing the change in his journalism, that ferocious ambition to reach out and touch people, which had made his writing heavy-handed at first, had been replaced by a more effective, matter-of-fact style. She knew he would pull out all the stops now that he had been given the chance to help Blomkvist with the Balder story. The plan was for Blomkvist to write the big central narrative, and for Xander to help with research, as well as writing some explanatory sidebars. Berrier thought they made a great team. After parking on Hökensgata, she walked into the offices and found Blomkvist and Xander sitting there, deep in concentration, just as she expected. Every now and then Blomkvist muttered to himself, and she saw that sense of purpose in his eyes. But there was also suffering. He had hardly slept all night. The media campaign against him had not let up, and in his police interviews he had to do the very thing the press accused him of. Withhold information. Blomkvist did not like it one bit. He was in many ways a model, law-abiding citizen, but if there was anyone who could get him to cross the line, it was Lisbeth Salander. Blomkvist would rather dishonour himself than betray her, which is why he kept repeating to the police, "I assert my right to protect my sources." No wonder he was unhappy and worried about the consequences. But, like Berrier, he had far greater fears for Salander and the boy than for their own situation.
"How's it going?" she asked, after watching him for a while.
"What? Well, okay. How was it out there?"
"I made up the beds and put food in the fridge."
"Good. And the neighbours didn't see you?"
"There wasn't a soul out."
"Why are they taking so long?" he said.
"I don't know, but I'm worried sick."
"Let's hope they're resting at Lisbeth's."
"Let's hope so. What else did you find out?"
"Quite a bit, but..." Blomkvist trailed off.
"Yes?"
"It's just that it feels as if I'm being thrown back in time, or going back to places I've been to before."
"You'll have to explain better," she said.
"I will." Blomkvist glanced at his computer screen. "But first I have to keep on digging. Let's speak later," he said. And so she left him and got her things to drive home, although she would be ready to join him at a second's notice.
Chapter 20. November 23rd. The night had turned out to be calm, alarmingly calm, and at 8 in the morning a brooding Bublansky stood facing his team in the meeting room. Having kicked out Faste, he felt reasonably sure that he could talk freely again. At least he felt safer in here with his colleagues than at his computer or with his mobile.
"You all appreciate how serious the situation is," he said.
Confidential information has been leaked. One person is dead as a result. A small boy's life is in danger. In spite of immense efforts, we still don't know how this happened. The leak could have been at our end, or at Seppo, or at Odin's medical center, or in the group around Professor Edelman, or from the boy's mother and her partner, Lasse Westman. We know nothing for certain, and therefore we have to be extremely circumspect, paranoid even.
We may also have been hacked or phone-tapped, Modig said. We seem to be dealing with criminals whose command of new technologies is far beyond anything we've seen before.
Very true, Poblansky said. We need to take precautions at every level, not say anything significant relating to this investigation or to any other, over the telephone, no matter how highly our superiors rate our new mobile phone system.
They think it's great because it costs so much to install, Holmberry said.
Maybe we should also be reflecting a little on our own role, Poblansky said, ignoring him.
I was just talking to a gifted young analyst at Seppo, Gabriella Grana. You may have heard of her. She pointed out that the concept of loyalty is not as straightforward as one might think for us policemen. We have many different loyalties, don't we? There's the obvious one, to the law. There's loyalty to the public and to one's colleagues, but also to our bosses and to ourselves and our careers. Sometimes, as you all know, these interests end up competing with each other. We might choose to protect a colleague at work and thereby fail in our duty to the public, or we might be given orders from higher up, like Hans Faster was, and then that conflicts with the loyalty he should have had to us. But from now on, and I'm deadly serious, there's only one loyalty I want to hear of, and that is to the investigation itself. We're going to catch the murderers, and we're going to make sure that no one else falls victim to them. Agreed? Even if the Prime Minister himself, or the head of the CIA, calls and goes on about patriotism and huge career opportunities, you still won't utter a peep, will you?
No, they all said in unison. Excellent.
As we all know, the person who intervened on Sveavägen was none other than Lisbeth Salander, and we're doing everything in our power to locate her.
Which is why we've got to release her name to the media, Svensson called out, somewhat heatedly. We need help from the public.
We don't all agree on this, I know, so I'd like to raise the question again. Let's remember that in the past Lisbeth Salander has had some very shabby treatment, from us and from the media.
At this point that doesn't matter, Svensson said.
And it's conceivable that people recognised her on Sveavägen, and her name will come out at any moment anyway. In which case this would no longer be an issue. But before that happens, keep in mind, she saved the boy's life.
No doubt about that, Svensson said. But then she more or less kidnapped him.
Our information suggests that she was determined to protect the boy at all costs, Modig said. Salander's experience of public institutions has been anything but positive. Her entire childhood was marred by the injustices inflicted on her by Swedish officialdom. If she suspects, as we do, that there's a leak inside the police force, then there's no chance she's going to contact us. Fact.
That's irrelevant, Svensson insisted.
Maybe, Modig said. Jan and I share your view that the most important thing here is whether it's in the interests of the investigation to release her name. And as to the investigation, our priority is the boy's safety, and that's where we have a big element of uncertainty.
I follow your reasoning, Holmberry said in a low, thoughtful tone, which immediately commanded everyone's attention. If people know of Salander's involvement, then the boy will be at risk. But that still leaves a number of questions. First, what's the ethical thing to do? But I have to say, even if there's been a leak here, we cannot accept that Salander should keep the boy hidden away. He's a crucial part of the investigation, and leak or no leak, we're better at protecting a child than an emotionally disturbed young woman could ever be.
Absolutely, of course, Poblansky muttered.
And even if this isn't a kidnapping in the ordinary sense, yes, even if it's been carried out with the best of intentions, the potential harm to the child could be just as great. Psychologically, it must be hugely damaging for him to be, as it were, on the run after everything he has been through.
True, Poblansky said, but the question still remains. How do we handle the information we have?
There I agree with Kurt. We have to release her name and photo right away. It could produce invaluable leads.
Probably, Poblansky said,
but it could at the same time give the killers invaluable leads. We have to assume that they haven't given up looking for the boy. Quite the opposite, in fact. And since we have no idea what the connection is between the boy and Salander, we don't know what sort of clues her name would provide them with. I'm not persuaded that we would be protecting the boy by giving the media these details.
But neither do we know if we're protecting him by holding them back, Holmbury said. There are too many pieces of the puzzle missing for us to draw any conclusions. Is Salander doing this for someone else, for example? Does she have her own agenda for the child, other than to protect him?
And how could she have known that the boy and Torkel Lindén would come out into Sveavägen at that exact moment? Svensson said.
Maybe she just happened to be there.
Doesn't seem likely.
The truth is often unlikely, Boblansky said. That's the nature of truth. But I agree. It doesn't feel like a coincidence, not under the circumstances.
What about the fact that Mikael Blomqvist also knew something was going to happen? Amanda Flod said.
There's some sort of connection between Blomqvist and Salander, Holmbury said.
True.
Blomqvist knew that the boy was at Odin's Medical Center, didn't he?
The mother told him, Boblansky said. As you might imagine, she's feeling desperate right now. I've just had a long conversation with her. But there was no reason on earth why Blomqvist should have known that the boy and Lindén would be tricked into going out onto the street.
Could he have had access to a computer at Odin's? Flood said pensively. I can't imagine Mikael Blomqvist getting involved in hacking, Modig said.
But what about Salander? Holmberry said. What do we actually know about her? We have a massive file on the girl, yet the last time we had anything to do with her, she surprised us on every count. Maybe appearances are just as deceptive this time around.
I agree, Svensson said. We have far too many question marks.
Question marks are about all we have, and that's exactly why we ought to stick to the rules, Holmberry said.
I didn't realize the rule book covered quite so much, Boblansky said, with a sarcasm even he did not like.
I only mean that we should take this for what it is, the kidnapping of a child. They disappeared almost 24 hours ago. We haven't heard a word from them. We should put out Salander's name and picture, and then look carefully at all the tip-offs that come in, Holmberry said with authority. He seemed to have the backing of the whole group, and at that, Boblansky closed his eyes and reflected that he loved them all. He felt a greater affinity with his team than he did for his own brothers and sisters, or even his parents. But right now he felt compelled to disagree with them.
We'll do everything we can to try to find them. But for the time being we will not release the name and picture. That would only make the situation more fraught, and I don't want to risk giving the killers any leads at all.
And you feel guilty, Holmberry said, without warmth.
I feel very guilty, Boblansky said, thinking again of his rabbi.
Blomqvist was so worried about the boy and Salander that he had hardly slept. Time and again he had tried to reach Salander on her Redphone app, but she had not answered. He had not heard a word from her since yesterday afternoon. Now he was sitting in the office, trying to immerse himself in his work and figure out what it was that had escaped him. For some time already he had had a sense, impossible to put his finger on, that there was a key piece missing, something which could shed light on the whole story. Perhaps he was fooling himself. Maybe it was just wishful thinking, a need to see a grand design. The last message from Salander on the encrypted link was, "Yuri Bogdanov. Check him out. He's the one who sold Baldur's technology to Ekavalt at Solifon." There were some images of Bogdanov online. They showed him wearing pinstriped suits which fit perfectly, but still managed to look wrong on him, as if he had stolen them on the way to the photographers. Bogdanov had long, lank hair, a pock-marked face, and large rings under his eyes, and you could just about make out some amateurish tattoos beneath his shirt cuffs. His look was dark, intense, and piercing. He was tall, but cannot have weighed more than 130 pounds. He looked like an old jailbird, but most striking there was something about his body language, which Blomqvist recognized from the images on the surveillance cameras at Baldur's place. The man gave the same tattered, rough-edged impression. There were also interviews he had given as a businessman in Berlin, in which he vouchsafed that he had been born more or less on the streets.
"I was doomed to end up dead in an alleyway with a needle stuck in my arm, but I managed to pull myself out of the muck.
I'm intelligent, and I'm one hell of a fighter," he said. There was nothing in the details of his life to contradict these claims, save for the suspicion that he may not have been raised exclusively through his own efforts. There were clues to suggest he had been given a helping hand by powerful people who had spotted his talent. In a German technology magazine, a security chief at the Horst Credit Institution was quoted as saying, "Bogdanov has magic in his eyes. He can detect vulnerabilities in security systems like no one else. He's a genius." So Bogdanov was a star hacker, although the official version had him acting only as a white hat, someone who served the good legal side, who helped companies identify flaws in their IT security in exchange for decent compensation. There was nothing in the least suspicious about his company, Outcast Security. The board members were all respectable, well-educated people. But Blomqvist did not leave it at that. He and Zander scrutinized every individual who had had any contact with the company, even partners of partners. And they noticed that somebody called Orlov had been a deputy board member only for a short time, which seemed strange. Vladimir Orlov was no IT man, but a minor player in the construction sector. He had once been a promising heavyweight boxer in the Crimea, and judging by the few pictures Blomqvist found online, he looked ravaged and brutal. There were rumours that he had been convicted of assault and procuring. He had been married twice. Both wives were dead, and Blomqvist had not been able to find a cause of death in either case. But the most interesting discovery he made was that the man had served as a substitute board member of a company, minor and long since defunct, by the name of Modin Construction and Export, which had dealt in sales of construction materials. The owner of the company had been Carl Axel Modin, the alias of Alexander Zalachenko, a name that revived memories of the evil conspiracy which became the subject of Millennium's greatest scoop. Zalachenko, who was Salander's father and her dark shadow, the black heart behind her throbbing determination to exact revenge. Was it a coincidence that his name cropped up? Blomqvist knew better than anyone that if you dig deep enough into a story, you will always find links. Life is constantly treating us to illusory connections. It was just that when it came to Lisbeth Salander, he stopped believing in coincidence. If she broke a surgeon's fingers, or delved into the theft of some advanced AI technology, you could be sure that she had not only thought it through to the last particle, she would also have a reason. Salander was not one to forget an injustice. She retaliated, and she righted wrongs. Could her involvement in this story be connected to her own background? It was by no means inconceivable. Blomqvist looked up from his computer and glanced at Zander. Zander nodded back at him. The faint smell of something cooking was coming from the kitchen. Thudding rock music could be heard from Jutgatan. Outside the storm was howling, and the sky was still dark and wild. Blomqvist went into the encrypted link out of habit, not expecting to find anything, but then his face lit up. He even let out a small whoop of joy. It said, "Okay now, we'll be going to the safe house shortly." He wrote, "Great news, drive carefully." Then he could not resist adding, "Who are we actually after?" She answered at once, "You'll soon work it out, smart ass." "Okay" was an exaggeration. Salander was better, but still in bad shape. For half of yesterday, in her apartment, she had been barely conscious, and only managed, with the greatest difficulty, to drag herself out of bed to see that August had something to eat and drink, and make sure he had pencils, crayons, and paper. But as she approached him now, she could see, even from a distance, that he had drawn nothing. There was paper scattered all over the coffee table in front of him, but no drawings. Instead, she saw rows of scribbles. More absent-mindedly than out of curiosity, she tried to make out what they were. He had written numbers, endless series of numbers, and even if at first they made no sense to her, she was intrigued. Suddenly she gave a whistle. "Oh, my God," she muttered. They were staggeringly large numbers, which formed a familiar pattern alongside the numbers next to them. As she looked through the papers and came across the simple sequence, 641, 647, 653, and 659, there was no longer any doubt. They were sexy prime quadruplets, sexy in the sense that they differed from each other by six. There were also twin primes,
and every other imaginable combination of prime numbers. She could not help but smile. Wicked! But August neither responded nor looked up at her. He just kept kneeling by the coffee table, as if he wanted nothing more than to go on writing his numbers. It occurred to her that she had read something about savants and prime numbers, but she put it out of her mind. She was far too unwell for any kind of advanced thinking. Instead, she went into the bathroom and took two more vibromycin antibiotics, which had been lying around in her apartment for years. She packed her pistol and her computer, a few changes of clothes, and to be on the safe side, she put on a wig and a pair of dark glasses. When she was ready, she asked the boy to get up. He did not respond, just held his pencil in a tight grip. For a moment she stood in front of him, stumped. Then she said sternly, "Get up!" And he did. They put on their outer layers, took the lift down to the garage, and set off in her BMW for the safe house on Ingeru. Her left shoulder was tightly strapped, and it ached, so she steered with her right hand. The top of her chest was hurting. She had a fever and had to stop a couple of times at the side of the road to rest. When finally they got to the beach and the jetty by Store Banvik on Ingeru, and followed the directions to climb the wooden stairs alongside the slope to the house, she collapsed, exhausted, on the first bed she saw. She was shivering and freezing cold. Soon after, breathing laboriously, she got up and sat at the kitchen table with her laptop, trying once more to crack the file she had downloaded from the NSA. But she did not even come close. August sat next to her, looking stiffly at the pile of paper and crayons Berrier had left for him, no longer interested in prime numbers, still less in drawing pictures. Perhaps he was in shock. The man who called himself Jan Holzer was sitting in a room at the Clarion Hotel Arlanda, talking on the telephone with his daughter. As he had expected, she did not believe him.
"Are you scared of me?" she said. "Are you afraid I'm going to cross-examine you?"
"No, Olga, absolutely not," he said. "It's just that—" He could not find the words. He knew Olga could tell he was hiding something, and ended the conversation sooner than he wanted to. Bogdanov was sitting next to him on the hotel bed, swearing. He had been through Balder's computer at least 100 times and found fuck all, as he put it.
"Not a single fucking thing." "I stole a computer with nothing on it," Holzer said.
"Right. So what was the professor using it for?"
"For something very important, clearly. I can see that a large file, presumably connected to other computers, was deleted recently, but I can't recover it. He knew his stuff, that guy."
"Useless," Holzer said.
"Completely fucking useless.
And the black phone?"
"There are a couple of calls I haven't been able to trace. Presumably from the Swedish Security Services or the NDRE, but there's something bothering me much more."
"What?"
"A long conversation the professor had just before you stormed in. He was talking to someone at the MIRI, Machine Intelligence Research Institute."
"What's the problem with that?"
"The timing. I get the feeling he was having some sort of crisis. Also, this institute works to ensure that intelligent computers don't become a threat to mankind. It doesn't look good. Balder could have given the MIRI his research, or—"
"Or what?"
"Or he could have spilled the beans on us. At least, what he knew."
"That would be bad."
Bogdanov nodded, and Holzer swore quietly. Nothing had gone as planned, and neither of them was used to failing, but here were two major mistakes in a row, and all because of a child. A retarded child. That was bad enough, but the worst of it was that Kira was on her way, unhinged on top of everything else. Neither of them was used to that, either. On the contrary, they had grown accustomed to her cool elegance, the air of invincibility it gave their operations. Now she was furious, completely off the wall, screaming at them that they were useless, incompetent cretins. It was not so much that those shots may have missed Balder's son. It was because of the woman who had appeared out of nowhere and rescued the boy. That woman sent Kira around the bend. When Holzer had begun to describe her, the little he had seen, Kira bombarded him with questions. Every answer he gave was wrong, according to Kira. She went berserk, yelling that they should have killed her, and that this was typical of them, brainless, useless. Neither of them could make sense of her violent reaction. They had never heard her yell like that before. In fact, there was a lot they did not know about her.
Holzer would never forget his evening with her, in a suite at the Hotel d'Angleterre in Copenhagen. They had had sex for the third or fourth time, and afterwards had been lying in bed drinking champagne and chatting about his wars and his murders, as they so often did. While stroking her arm, he had discovered three scars, side by side on her wrist.
"How did you get those, gorgeous?"
he had said, and got a look of pure loathing in return. He had never been allowed to sleep with her again. He took it to be a punishment for having asked. Kirill looked after the group and gave them a lot of money, but neither he nor Bogdanov, nor anyone else, was allowed to ask about her past. That was one of the unspoken rules, and none of them would even dream of trying. For better or for worse, she was their benefactress, mostly for better, they thought, and they went along with her whims, living in constant uncertainty as to whether she would be affectionate or cold, or even give them a brutal, stinging slap. Bogdanov closed the computer and took a swallow of his drink. They were trying to limit their drinking, so that Kira would not use that against them, but it was nearly impossible. The frustration and adrenaline drove them to it. Holzer fingered his mobile nervously.
"Didn't Olga believe you?"
Bogdanov said.
"Not a word. Soon she'll see a child's drawing of me, on every billboard.
I don't buy that drawing thing. Probably wishful thinking on the part of the police.
So we're supposed to kill a child for no reason?
It wouldn't surprise me. Shouldn't Kirill be here by now?
Any minute.
Who do you think it was?"
"Who?"
"The girl who appeared from nowhere."
"No idea," Holzer said. "Not sure Kira knows either. But she's worried about something."
"We'll probably end up having to kill them both.
That might be the least of it."
August was not feeling well. That was obvious. Red patches flared on his throat, and he was clenching his fists. Salander, sitting next to him at the round table, working on her RSA encryption, was afraid he was on the verge of some sort of fit. But August only picked up a crayon, a black one. At the same moment a gust of wind shook the large window panes in front of them. August hesitated and moved his hand back and forth across the table. But then he started to draw. A line here, a line there, followed by some small circles, buttons, Salander thought, then a hand, details of a chin, an unbuttoned shirt front. It began to go more quickly, and the tension in the boy's back and shoulders subsided, as if a wound had burst open and begun to heal. There was a searing, tortured look in his eyes, and every now and then he shivered. But there was no doubt that something within him had eased. He picked up some new crayons and started to draw an oak-coloured floor, on which appeared pieces of a puzzle that seemed to represent a glittering town at night-time. It was clear at this stage that the drawing would be anything but a pleasant one. The hand and the unbuttoned shirt front became part of a large man with a protruding belly. The man was standing, bent like a jackknife, beating a small person on the floor, a person who is not in the drawing for the simple reason that he was observing the scene, and on the receiving end of the blows. It was an ugly scene, no doubt about that. But even though the picture revealed an assailant, it did not seem to have anything to do with the murder. Right in the middle, at the epicenter of the drawing, a furious, sweaty face appeared, every foul and bitter furrow captured with precision. Salander recognized it. She rarely watched TV or went to the cinema, but she knew it was the face of the actor Lasse Vestman, August's mother's partner. She leaned forward to the boy and said, with a holy, quivering rage,
"We'll never let him do that to you again. Never!"
Chapter 21. November 23rd. Casales knew at once that something was wrong when she saw Commander Ingram's lanky figure approach Needham's desk. You could tell from his hesitant manner that the news was not good. Ingram usually had a malicious grin on his face when he stuck a knife in someone's back, but with Needham it was different. Even the most senior bosses were scared of Needham. He would raise all hell if anyone tried to mess with him. Ingram did not like scenes, still less humiliation, and that was what awaited him if he picked a fight with Needham. While Needham was brash and explosive, Ingram was a refined, upper-class type, with spindly legs and an affected manner. Ingram was a serious power player and had influence where it mattered, be it in Washington or in the world of business. As a member of the NSA management, he ranked just below Admiral Charles O'Connor. He might be quick to smile and adept at handing out compliments, but his smile never reached his eyes. He had leverage over people and was, among other things, in charge of monitoring strategic technologies, more cynically known as industrial espionage, that part of the NSA which gives the American tech industry a helping hand in global competition. He was feared as few others were. But now as he stood in front of Needham in his fancy suit, his body seemed to shrink even from 100 feet away. Casales knew exactly what was about to happen. Needham was on the brink of exploding. His pale, exhausted face was going red. Without waiting, he got to his feet, his back crooked and bent, his belly sticking out, and roared in a furious voice, "You sleazy bastard!" No one but Needham would call Johnny Ingram a sleazy bastard, and Casales loved him for it. August started on a new drawing. He sketched a few lines. He was pressing so hard on the paper that the black crayon broke, and just like the last time, he drew rapidly, one detail here and another one there, disparate bits, which ultimately came together and formed a whole. It was the same room, but there was a different puzzle on the floor, easier to make out. It represented a red sports car racing by a sea of shouting spectators in a stand. Above the puzzle, not one, but two men could be seen standing. One of them was Vestman again. This time he was wearing a T-shirt and shorts, and he had bloodshot, squinting eyes. He looked unsteady and drunk, but no less furious. He was drooling. Yet he was not the most frightening figure in the drawing. That was the other man, whose watery eyes shone with pure sadism. He too was unshaven and drunk, and he had thin, almost non-existent lips. He seemed to be kicking August, although again the boy could not be seen in the picture, his very absence making him extremely present.
"Who's the other one?" Salander said.
August said nothing, but his shoulders shook and his legs twisted into a knot under the table.
"Who's the other one?"
Salander said again, in a more forceful tone, and August wrote on the drawing in a shaky, childish hand, R-O-G-E-R. Roger. The name meant nothing to Salander. A couple of hours later in Fort Meade, once his hacker boys had cleaned up after themselves and shuffled off, Needham walked over to Casales. The odd thing was, he no longer looked at all angry or upset. He was radiant with defiance and carrying a notebook. His shirt was disheveled.
"Hey, bud," she said, "tell me, what's going on?"
"I got some vacation time," he said. "I'm off to Stockholm."
"Of all places. Isn't it cold this time of year?"
"Freezing, by all accounts."
"So you're not really going there on vacation?"
"Strictly between us."
"Go on."
"Ingram ordered us to halt our investigation. The hacker goes free, and we're supposed to be satisfied with stopping up a few leaks. Then the whole thing gets swept under the carpet."
"How the hell can he lay down something like that?"
"They don't want to awaken any sleeping dogs," he says, "and run the risk of anyone finding out about the attack. It would be devastating if it ever got out. Just think of all the malicious glee and all the people whose heads would roll, starting with yours truly."
"He threatened you?"
"Did he ever? Went on about how I would be publicly humiliated, even sued."
"You don't seem worried."
"I'm going to break him."
"How? Our glamour boy has powerful connections everywhere, you know that."
"I have a few of my own. Besides, Ingram isn't the only one with dirt on people. That damn hacker was gracious enough to link and match our computer files and show us some of our own dirty laundry."
"That's ironic, isn't it?"
"It takes a crook to know one. At first, the data didn't look all that spectacular, not compared to the other stuff we're doing. But when we started to really get into it..."
"Yes?"
"It turned out to be dynamite."
"In what way?"
"Ingram's closest colleagues not only collect trade secrets to help our own major companies, sometimes they also sell the information for a lot of money. And that money, Alona, doesn't always find its way into the coffers of the organization."
"But into their own pockets."
Exactly. I already have enough evidence on that to put two of our top industrial espionage executives behind bars.
Jesus.
Unfortunately, it's less straightforward with Ingram. I'm convinced he's the brains behind the whole thing. Otherwise, all of this doesn't add up. But I don't have a smoking gun, not yet, which makes the whole operation risky. There's always a chance, though I wouldn't bet on it, that the file the hacker downloaded has something specific on him. But it's impossible to crack a goddamn RSA encryption.
So what are you going to do?
Tighten the net. Show the world that our own co-workers are in cahoots with criminal organizations.
Like the spiders.
Like the spiders. And plenty of other bad guys. It wouldn't surprise me if they were involved in the killing of your professor in Stockholm. They had a clear interest in seeing him dead.
You've got to be joking.
I'm completely serious. Your professor knew things that could have blown up in their faces.
Holy shit. And you're off to Stockholm like some private detective to investigate?
Not like a private detective, Alona. I'm going to be official. And while I'm there, I'm going to give our hacker such a pummeling she won't be able to stand.
Wait, did you say she?
You better believe it. Our hacker's a she.
August's drawings took Salander back in time. She thought of that fist beating rhythmically and relentlessly on the mattress. She remembered the thuds and the grunting and the crying from inside the bedroom next door. She remembered the times at Lundergarten, when her comics and fantasies of revenge were her only refuge. But she shook off the memories. She changed the dressing on her shoulder, then she checked her pistol, made sure that it was loaded. She went on to the PGP link. Andre Zander was asking how they were, and she gave a short reply. Outside, the storm was shaking the trees and bushes. She helped herself to some whiskey and a piece of chocolate, then went out onto the terrace, and from there to the rock slope, where she carefully reconnoitred the terrain, noticing a small cleft some way down. She counted her steps and memorized the lay of the land. By the time she got back, August had made another drawing of Estman and the Roger person. She supposed he needed to get it out of his system, but still he had not drawn anything from the night of the murder. Perhaps the experience was blocked in his mind. Salander was overcome by a feeling of time running away from them, and she cast a worried look at August. For a minute or so she focused on the mind-boggling numbers he had put down on paper. She studied their structure until suddenly she spotted a sequence which did not fit in with the others. It was relatively short. 2305843008139952128. She got it immediately. It was not a prime number. It was, and here her spirits lifted, a number which, according to a perfect harmony, is made up of a sum of all its positive divisors. It was, in other words, a perfect number, just as 6 is because it can be divided evenly by 3, 2, and 1, and 3 plus 2 plus 1 happened to add up to 6. She smiled. And then she had an exhilarating thought.
"Now you're going to have to explain yourself," Casada said.
"I will," Needham said. "But first, even though I trust you, I need you to give me a solemn promise that you won't say any of this to anybody."
"I promise, you jerk."
"Good. Here's the story. After I yelled at Ingram, mostly for the sake of appearances, I told him he was right. I even pretended to be grateful to him for putting a stop to our investigation. We wouldn't have gotten any further anyway, I said, and it was partly true. From a purely technical point of view, we were out of options. We'd done everything, and then some, but it was pointless. The hacker put red herrings all over the place and kept leading us into new mazes and labyrinths. One of my guys said that even if we got to the end, against all odds, we wouldn't believe we'd made it. We'd kid ourselves that it was a new trap. We were prepared for just about anything from this hacker, anything but flaws and weaknesses. So if we kept going the usual way, we'd had it."
"You don't tend to go the usual way."
"No, I preferred a roundabout way. The truth is, we hadn't given up at all. We'd been talking to our hacker contacts out there, and our friends in the software companies. We did advanced searches, surveillance, and our own computer breaches. You see, when an attack is as complex as this one, you can always be sure there's been some research up front. Certain specific questions have been asked. Certain specific sites have been visited, and inevitably some of that becomes known to us. But there was one factor above all that played into our hands, Alona.
the hacker's skill. It was so incredible that it limited the number of suspects. Like a criminal suddenly running 100 meters in 9.7 seconds at a crime scene. You'd be pretty sure the guy's a certain Mr. Bolt, or one of his close rivals, right?